Okay, we're beginning here on the top of Chet Amud Aleph, five lines down. The Gemara is discussing the question with regards to the two braitot that seem to be soter, achadat tesheni. One braita that says, if you bring a get in a sfina, in a boat, it's like bringing it from Eretz Yisrael. The other braita says that when you bring it in a boat, it's as if it is chutz la'aretz. So we had the first attempt to reconcile between the braitot and say that it's a machloket, Rabbi Huda and the Chachamim, with regards to the status of a boat in the rivers of Eretz Yisrael. Then we had a second attempt to explain it, that it was Rabbi Huda, and it depends on the status of the boat. And then, now we have a third attempt at explaining that, which is Rav Nachman Yitzchak Amar, Benarot Eretz Yisrael, Dekulei Ama Lo Plige. Everybody agrees when you're in the rivers of Eretz Yisrael, Eleki Plige B'Yam HaGadol. The argument revolves around the Yam HaGadol or the Mediterranean. Within the water bodies of Eretz Yisrael, everybody agrees that it is deemed as if you are inside of Eretz Yisrael. As Rashi says, the time of the get, lo mishum nika min hakarkahu. That the reasoning behind get has nothing to do with the reasons behind mitzvot atzuliot ba'aretz and whether something is considered to be planted in Eretz Yisrael or not. So Rabbi Huda and the Chachamim's positions over there aren't necessarily relevant, because that's talking about whether you have Kedushat Ha'aretz or not Kedushat Ha'aretz. By get, we want to know, are you over the border? Are you in Eretz Yisrael? Is it coming from a place where they know how to make a get? So with regards to the rivers, everybody agrees that it's not problematic. What is their question? Eleki Pligi B'Yam HaGadol, with regards to the Mediterranean, what is the status of the Mediterranean? D'Tanya, we have a Braita. Again, this is a Tosefta and Shumot. Here, it is enumerating the borders of Eretz Yisrael, but these are the borders of Olei Mitzrayim. So in our Mishnah, we dealt with the borders of Olei Bavel, which are the most relevant in terms of the halachot of Gitin, as well as according to most Rishonim with regards to where the dinim of Shumot Masrot, Kedushat Ha'aretz, and Shemitah apply, is the borders of Olei Bavel, not of Olei Mitzrayim. On the other hand, here the Braita is describing to us the boundaries set out by the Torah for the Olei Mitzrayim when they came into Eretz Yisrael. And here it says, Ezehu Aretz, Vezehu Chutz Laretz. What's considered to be Eretz Yisrael? What's considered to be Chutz Laretz? Kol, Sheshofea, Vioreid, Miture Amnon, Vilifnim, Eretz Yisrael, Miture Amnon, Vilachutz, Chutz Laretz. So the border that they're speaking about here is a northwestern border of Eretz Yisrael. It is the mountain range that runs probably towards northern Lebanon and into Syria. A mountain range that separates the Middle East from Asia Minor, from Turkey and those areas. So that mountain range is the northern border of Eretz Yisrael. And here, Ture Amnon are associated with Hor HaHar, which is mentioned in the Torah as the northwestern border of Eretz Yisrael. Not the Hor HaHar where Aaron died, but another Hor HaHar, which is in the northwest corner of the borders of Eretz Yisrael. And so Ture Amnon is the translation, the Targum of Hor HaHar. So now, in delineating the northern border, it tells you that this mountain or this mountain range is the border. And then it says Lifnim and Chutz. So the difficulty with Lifnim and Chutz is, what is inside or outside? Rashi claims here that the issue is the north and south border of Eretz Yisrael, which means that a mountain has a peak to it, and then there's the slope of the mountain. So when the Braita is describing Lifnim and Chutz, it's describing the slope of the mountain on either side. The peak of the mountain is the border, and then the slope of the mountain towards Eretz Yisrael, southernly slope of the mountain, is considered to be Eretz Yisrael. The northern slope of the mountain is considered to be Chutz Laretz. That's the way that Rashi reads it. Whereas Tosafot says that Nira Lari, the Turi Amnon, Mishtapeh Abireid, Litzad Mizrach, Litzad Marav. Tosafot says he doesn't think it's a north-south slope, but rather an east-west slope. A lot of what he has to do is because it's on the shoreline, it's on the water, and therefore the mountain itself slopes down into the water. And so Tosafot says over here, the Lifnim and the Chutz is an east-west question, and that which is Lifnim, that which is to the eastern side, is considered to be Eretz Yisrael. That which is to the western side, or the western slope, is considered to be Chutz La'aretz. So that's the way Tosafot reads it over here. But first of all, you do have mountains that are that way. I mean, that obviously every side has a slope, but the question of where the slope is versus the face of the mountain will be a sheer face, and then you won't have a slope on that side. So I think that's what they're discussing over here, which is the If you think about the mountain range that comes, the mountain range moves from east to west, and it turns in a southerly direction. So the question of the slope is, that mountain, the range itself is a north-south divider. But that mountain, because the slopes turn a little bit southward, that mountain itself could be sloping west and east versus sloping north and south. And I think that's the question that's facing Tosfot. Tosfot talks about why Rashi thinks this, because the way that it's described in the Torah, this is the northern border of Eretz Yisrael. Tosfot just points out that it's not just the northern border, it's also the northwestern border. It's a corner. And therefore, the slope makes a difference. The truth is, what you're saying might be true, is that Lifnim might refer to two sides of the mountain. It might be both the southern side and the eastern side are Lifnim, and the northern and western side are Bechutz, and they're both Rashi and Tosfot are right, because the mountain has four sides to it. Now, Hanasin Shibiyam. What about the islands in the water, in the Mediterranean? Ruinotan kilu chut matuach alehem. We look at them as if there is a string or a straight line pulled. Miture Amnon ad Nachal Mitzrayim. From Ture Amnon, which is the northwestern border of Eretz Yisrael, to Nachal Mitzrayim, which is the southwestern border of Eretz Yisrael. Minachut vilifnim. From that line inward, Eretz Yisrael. Minachut vilachutz, chutz laretz. From that line and outwards, that is considered to be chutz laretz. So, in your mind, you know what the picture of Eretz Yisrael looks like, which is Eretz Yisrael is much narrower at the top and widens towards the bottom. It has almost an inverse hourglass shape to it, which is that it's very narrow at the top, narrow at the bottom, and has a wide center around the areas of the Negev. Obviously here, if you add in the Sinai as well, which seems to be added in, if you put in Nachal Mitzrayim, then you add in the Sinai as well, the Sinai Peninsula, then you have a very, very wide base to Eretz Yisrael. So that means that the southwestern border of Eretz Yisrael is much further west than the northwestern border of Eretz Yisrael. So now the question is, what is the western border? The Torah says that the western border is the Yam, is the Mediterranean. How do you look at the Mediterranean? Do you just follow the coastline, which we'll see in a second, is one possibility. Or do you take the northwestern border, southwestern border, draw a straight line between them? You draw a straight line between them, that means the line crosses the Mediterranean itself. And that's what is being described here, that that line that crosses the Mediterranean itself makes a dividing line that part of Eretz Yisrael, or Kedushat Ha'aretz, applies inside the Mediterranean. Or what in modern day terms is territorial waters. Right? The waters off the coast of your country belong to the country. How far that extends is always a question. But here you have a line that delineates, according to this, until where is considered to be Eretz Yisrael. So now, Rabbi Yehuda Omer, Kol sheneged Eretz Yisrael, arehu ke'Eretz Yisrael. Anything that is opposite Eretz Yisrael has a din of Eretz Yisrael. So I mentioned this in the Mishnah, and the Balei Tosafot are going to take up this Shita, but according to Rabbi Yehuda, anything west of Eretz Yisrael is considered to be Eretz Yisrael. Shenamar, ugvul hayam, vayalechem hayam agadol ugvul, zeliyalechem gvul yam. So again, the word gvul appears numerous times in the Pasuk, and basically, the way that he interprets it is that the Yamagadol Gvul means that the Yamagadol will extend the Gvul on the western side. Vanesin Shibit Stadim, the islands that are west of Eretz Yisrael, Royotim Kilu Chut Matuach Alehem. We see as if there is a straight line pulled across them. Mikafloria Vad Yom Akyanus. Yom Akyanus is the Atlantic. Both Rashi and Tosafot here make a comment, which obviously was in their case true, which is Shehi Sofa Olam, which is the end of the world. The Atlantic Ocean was the end of what they knew as the settled, known world at that time. So now Mikafloria would be in the north, Uminachal Mitzrayim Yad Yamokuyanus in the south. So basically, what Rabbi Yehuda says is, we're taking a point in the north. The way that they describe this is Kafloria was a settlement on the top of Ture Amnon. It was a city or a settlement at the top there. Nachal Mitzrayim being the southwest border, the other being the northwest border. You take a point from there and extend it out west to the Atlantic Ocean. So the upper line runs from Kafloria out to the Atlantic Ocean, a westerly line, and then the southern line runs from Nachal Mitzrayim west, directly west, out to the Mediterranean. And Rabbi Yehuda says, anything that is found between those two lines is considered to be Eretz Yisrael. Wow. So that's a very large area, which leads to the problem of the Balei HaTosafot, which is, Shael Rabbeinu Peter, Lo Rabbeinu Tam. So Rabbeinu Peter asked Rabbeinu Tam, "Tibzman hazeh hayalit chayev the Rabbi Yehuda maser shanu b'marava shel Eretz Yisrael." He says we're in southern France. Southern France is included in those lines, meaning that the boundary to the north includes a lot of southern Europe, and the boundary to the south includes a lot of northern Africa. Eshiv lo to lo kaimalang to Rabbi Yehuda. It's an interesting answer. Rabbeinu Tam doesn't say you're wrong, but rather we don't paskin like Rabbi Yehuda. So that might have to do with it, Oli Bavel, Oli Mitzrayim. But his answer is, technically, you're right. But then, Tosfot asks another question, which is, even according to Rabbi Yehuda, how does he know that everything west of Eretz Yisrael, between those two lines, that those people were considered to be Biki'im in Lishma, or that there was free flow of traffic between them? How does he know that Gitin that come from those areas are all fine? The truth is that it's not such a far-fetched assumption, because most of the trade and the traffic was along the Mediterranean, and therefore anything that is basically on the shorelines of the Mediterranean, north and south, would have access to these types of information. There was free flow of traffic. It's not so far-fetched. But then Tosfot gives an alternate answer, which changes the whole dynamic of what Rabbi Yehuda says. He says, "V'kach yesh lomar, d'lo kavshu akol olei Bavel." Number one is the Olei Bavel did not capture all these areas. So I mentioned this already, that there's a difference between Olei Bavel and Olei Mitzrayim. And therefore, we're governed by Olei Bavel, not Olei Mitzrayim. Enoch and Ami, had we been governed by Olei Mitzrayim, it would have included southern Europe and northern Africa. But that's not the Kedushat Haaretz that governs today. It's the Kedushat Shniyah, which is Olei Bavel, and that's a much smaller, narrower area that does not encompass southern Europe and northern Africa. Inami, the third answer is, Kedepeirish Bekuntris, the Chol Shekeneged Eretz Yisrael, Hainu Kol Hayam Shekeneged Yisrael. Rashi over here says when Rabbi Yehuda means to the west of Eretz Yisrael, it doesn't mean anything west between these two lines. It means that any island found in the Mediterranean between these two lines is deemed like Eretz Yisrael. The Mediterranean itself is the border, is the western border, but that border ends near Gibraltar, where the end of the Mediterranean, where the Mediterranean meets the Atlantic. So at that point, that's the end of the border. But only things that are contained within the water body of the Mediterranean have the din, according to Rabbi Yehuda, of Eretz Yisrael. It's just those islands that are there. And Tosfot in the end says, V'yesh lomar she'yodea. Now, once you limit it to the islands in the Mediterranean, that he knew shekulam ayu bikim lishma. Tisha yadu lehem ad heichan Yisrael omdim, misham melech lo Yisrael ad sof olam. Says basically, they know there are a limited number of islands in the Mediterranean, and they knew where Jews lived in the Mediterranean. And so he knew up to the point where the Jews were, they clearly knew lishma. Beyond that, Jews didn't live in the Mediterranean islands, and so it wasn't an issue anymore. A number of interesting issues, one of which in the introduction of the Masechta, I mentioned this Shita of the Balei HaTosafot, that Kedushat Haaretz extends to southern Europe and northern Africa, which is an amazing concept. I mean, that they don't dismiss it outright, they dismiss it for technical reasons rather than for halachic reasons. So that's very interesting. I mean, they do in the end, and according to Rashi, say that it has nothing to do with the land masses, only has to do with the islands. The second thing that's very interesting, the Gemara here describes a line running from Ture Amnon down to Nachal Mitzrayim, which incorporates all the islands that are in the Mediterranean between that line. There are no current islands. Today, if you look in the Mediterranean, there are no islands there. But the Gemara clearly thinks that there were Nasim Shebiyam at that time. So the question of whether there were areas there that had higher land masses that actually created islands in the Mediterranean. So either those land masses were higher, or the Mediterranean was slightly lower, so it exposed these land bars that were there, which we know there are along that area. There are land bars that are pretty high, but otherwise there are no islands, and maybe it's just a theoretical question of Nasin Shebiyam between those lines. But otherwise, if you draw the line, the closest island to us is Cyprus. Cyprus, I don't think, is captured by this line. So therefore, what exactly they're speaking about is not clear here within the Gemara. And so either there was a different topography to the area, which is not inconceivable given the seismic activity in the area, or they're just speaking in a theoretical sense that that line would have included Nasin Shebiyam. And the more relevant issue is boats that are found inside of that line. Are they deemed to be inside of Eretz Yisrael at that point? And the answer would be yes, the Gitin, according to this. So the difference between them is how far west does the border extend. According to the Chachamim, the border ends at that straight line between Ture Amnon and Nachal Mitzrayim, whereas Rabbi Yehuda extends all the way down the Mediterranean until you hit the Atlantic Ocean. So boats that are found in the Mediterranean, what's their status when they are west of that line? According to the Chachamim, they're Chutz Laaretz. According to Rabbi Yehuda, they're considered to be Eretz Yisrael. And that, according to Rabbi Nachman Yitzchak, is the difference in the Breitut that we brought before. Is the boat considered to be in Eretz Yisrael? Is it considered to be in Chutz La'aretz? Depends if you hold like the Chachamim or Rabbi Yehuda with regards to the western border. But therefore, according to Rabbi Yehuda, Minachut v'lifni, Minachut doesn't mean, it means in between these two lines is Eretz Yisrael. Minachut v'lachutz, outside of these two lines, is considered to be Chutz La'aretz, and we already discussed in the Balei Tosafot the different possibilities of what it means inside the lines, or outside the lines, what's incorporated there. For Rabbanan v'hai u'givul, my abdile, the extra u'givul that is put next to Hayama Gadol u'givul, that extra givul over there, what do they do with it? Mibaylein and asin, to include the islands that are in the Mediterranean. Again, what I just discussed is relevant because according to the Chachamim, with the line that draws from Turei Amnon, Harei Amnon, down to Nachal Mitzrayim, there really are no islands there, but they're including. So, question about what exactly they're referencing. Rabbi Yehuda, asin lo tzrichi kro. What do you need a special pasuk to tell you about the islands? Of course they're included. If you're in the border, you're in the border. If you're not in the border, you're not in the border. You don't have to include the islands. You just have to know where the border is. And the border, ugvul, makes as if it says there that Yama Gadol is the gvul. What does that mean, Yama Gadol is the gvul? The Mediterranean becomes the borderline itself. Not the eastern side of the Mediterranean, but rather the western side of the Mediterranean. Right now, Rabbi Meir Omer, Akko ke Eretz Yisrael. Rabbi Meir argues on this position that Akko, which is the northern border, the way that Rabbi Yehuda terms it is that Akko is the northern border, but Akko is Kechutz La'aretz. Rabbi Meir says it's like Eretz Yisrael. Bamine Rabbi Chia bar Abba, Hamocher Abdol Surya, Komocher B'chutz La'aretz Dami Olo. So the question posed to Rabbi Chia bar Abba is a person who sells his Eved to Surya. Surya is what we would call the modern day Syria, but it means very north. North of Eretz Yisrael, probably most likely northeast of Eretz Yisrael. Remember, there is, in terms of travel between Eretz Yisrael and Bavel, Bavel is found northeast of Eretz Yisrael. And so if you were to travel from Eretz Yisrael to Bavel, the likely route that you took was up through the Galil or Golan, and then eastward through Syria out to Bavel. That area of Syria falls under a category of questionable status. Both because it's a land bridge between Bavel and Eretz Yisrael, but more so because David HaMelech conquers those areas when he's the king and extends the overall reach of Eretz Yisrael to that northeastern area of Syria. And those are probably the most extensive borders of Eretz Yisrael, both in the time of David and Shlomo, maybe also later on in the time of possibly Achav. And then again, in the late Hashmonaic period, also, the borders get pretty far to the northeast in the conquering of those areas. Amocher Abdol Surya, Kemocher Bechutz La'aretz Dami Olo. When you sell an Eved out to Surya, is that as if you sold it out to Chutz La'aretz? The relevance of that is a question, which will come up in the Mishnah later in the Masechta, which is a person who sells their Eved to Chutz La'aretz, actually the buyer loses his right to the Eved, and the Eved goes free. Because you are now taking your Eved out of Eretz Yisrael and putting him in Chutz La'aretz, the way Rashi terms it is, your mafkiel to me mitzvot. Eved kanani is chayav in mitzvot ki isha, and being in Eretz Yisrael affords him the opportunity to do more mitzvot, mitzvot atluyot paret, versus in Syria, where he won't have that opportunity. Now, it's not so clear that that's the case, we'll see in a second, because we're going to see that in Syria they also have mitzvot atluyot paret, and even according to this sheet, it was midoraita, that they have mitzvot atluyot paret in Surya. So it seems that the big issue is that you're taking him out from a Eretz Tahara or an Eretz Kedosha and putting him in Eretz Tameah or an Eretz that lacks that Kedusha. So that downgrading of the status or the spiritual aspect of his life grants him the right to go free because you are causing this Eved a downgrade in his religious experience. So that's the question. Is that the case? Samalu Tinitua. It's our Mishnah. Rabbi Meir Omer, Akko ke Eretz Yisrael de Gitin, the Gitinin lavadim lo. When Rabbi Meir argues on Rabbi Yehuda in the Mishnah and says that Akko has a status of Eretz Yisrael, that is true for Gitin. But as far as avadim are concerned, it's considered to be Chutz La'aretz. V'chol shekein Surya de Merchaka Tuva. The reason that he picks on Akko is because Akko is a northern border of Eretz Yisrael. It's northwestern border of Eretz Yisrael. Again, yesterday we saw the possibility that some thought it was a northeastern border, but either way, it's the northern border. And it's far south of the areas that were known as Surya or Aram in the time of the Tanakh. It's far south of those areas. And if you're already saying over there that the border demarcates at Akko, and Akku is already Chutz La'aretz for Abadim, then certainly Surya is considered to be Chutz La'aretz for Abadim, and that is his answer. His answer is that even the argument in our Mishnah only revolves around the issue of Gitin. Now, we've mentioned it a number of times that maybe there's a difference with the dinim of Gitin versus Kedushat Haaretz. The two may not be synonymous. But he says here, even those Machmir Shita that says that Eretz Yisrael extends unto Akko, that's first of all only for Gitin, and that's only to Akko. Beyond that is considered to be Chutz La'aretz. Tosfot Shita in the Mishnah is that half of Akko is Kadosh and the other half is not Kadosh, to reconcile what seems to be Stirot throughout Shas, whether Akko is or is not inside of Eretz Yisrael. In the end, the Tosfot brings the alternate, which is, seems to be the view here. There are different dinim. For certain dinim, Akko is Eretz Yisrael, and for certain dinim, Akko is Chutz La'aretz. So for Gitin, it's considered to be Eretz Yisrael. For Avadim and other areas, it's considered to be Chutz La'aretz. But if that's the case, Surya is clearly outside the bounds of Eretz Yisrael, and it's considered to be Chutz La'aretz. Tanu Banan, b'shlosha drachim shavta Surya l'Eretz Yisrael, u'b'shlosha l'Chutz La'aretz. So here you have a Braita, Tosefta and Kelim, delineating again the boundaries of Eretz Yisrael. And then in delineating the boundaries of Eretz Yisrael also has impact in terms of Tumah. Because there's a difference between Chutz La'aretz and Eretz Yisrael with regards to Tumat Eretz Amin. So here it tells you that Surya has some status like Eretz Yisrael and some status where it's differentiated from Eretz Yisrael. Basically continuing the discussion that we just opened over here with regards to the question of Gitin and Abadim in Chutz La'aretz. So it says here, you have a siman, which basically lays out the six items that have that difference, but Afrat Tamei k'chutz la'aretz. Its ground is considered to be Tamei like Chutz La'aretz, but Mocher Abdullah Surya k'mocher b'chutz la'aretz. So here you have a Tosef that corroborates what the answer that was given by Rabbi Chiya Ba'ava, that if you sell your Eved to Surya, it's like selling him into Chutz La'aretz, and then the penalty applies that he goes free. V'mevi get mi Surya k'mevi mi Chutz La'aretz. If you bring a get from Surya, it's also like bringing it from Chutz La'aretz. Again, we saw that the northern borders, as far as Gitin were concerned, were Akko. And so, Surya is clearly beyond those borders, and therefore doesn't have a status of Eretz Yisrael. Shlosha Eretz Yisrael, for three things it's considered to be like Eretz Yisrael. Chayevet v'maseru b'shvi'it ke'eretz Yisrael. Chayevet in Maisrot. Mitzvot ha'tzuliyot ha'aretz apply in Surya. Now, that could be rabbinic, that could be doraita. We're going to see that the Gemara is going to conclude that Tosefta thinks that it's doraita. That mina Torah, you're chayav in Shvi'it and Maser, Shemitah, and Shemot and Masrot in Surya, which begs the question of then why when you sell an Eved out there, what are you doing that's downgrading him? Because they still have mitzvot atzuyot ba'aretz. The difference being, tumat Eretz Ha'amin. That's really the key difference between Eretz Yisrael and Surya. Rotzeli kaneis la betara. Someone who wants to enter into that area, betara, nichnas, you can do it. V'akoneh sadeh b'Surya, person who buys a plot of land in Surya, kikoneh b'parvarei Yerushalayim. It's like buying in the palaces or the royal areas of Yerushalayim. Now the Gemara is going to dissect this braita, this tosefta, and go piece by piece in each of the halachot to explain the reasons behind the halachot. This could come up in a number of ways. The question of, first of all, Eber Yardain, what is the status of Eber Yardain versus Eretz Yisrael? Does it have a status of Eretz Yisrael? So it's a machloket, Rambam and Ramban, what exactly the status or the kedusha of Eber Yardain is. Does it have a status like Eretz Yisrael or not? And then later on in the poskim, in the shutim, it's also a question as to whether that has a status of Eretz Yisrael, which has nafkaminot for these halakhot. The same is true with Surya at the Tanaic level. At the Tanaic level, Surya is a machloket. So now here, if you deem Surya to be like Eretz Yisrael, or you deem Eber Yardain to be like Eretz Yisrael, then you have a situation in which this wife was begging her husband to make Aliyah, come to Eretz Yisrael. So he buys her a beautiful house in Amman, or in Damascus, and says, we're going, we can make Aliyah, we're going to Eretz Yisrael. If you deem these areas to be like Eretz Yisrael, then making Aliyah includes going to Amman, it includes going to Damascus, doesn't mean necessarily coming into the land of Israel. So that's what is being said here, that when you buy land in the area of Surya, it's like buying land in the middle of Yerushalayim. That means you buy land in Damascus, it's like buying land in Yerushalayim. Gemara goes through each one of them. Chayevet b'masir b'shvid k'Eretz Yisrael, why? Kasavar kibush yachid shmei kibush. He believes that the conquest of an individual has the status of conquest. Rashi already addresses part of the issue, which is kibush yachid de David. David conquered the areas of Aram Sova, Aram Naraim, all those areas that were up in the area of Syria. Shelo ayu kol Yisrael biyachad. Not all of Israel was together at that point. Kederach shayu bekibush Yoshua shayu kulam. So the first thing Rashi says is the difference between this kibush and that kibush is that the kibush of Yoshua was done by all of Klal Yisrael. Before they are mechalek, the Aretz, they all go around conquering the areas of Eretz Yisrael, and then they divide it up and settle it. But it is a conquest of all of Israel versus David's conquest of that area, which involves whether it's just the army or involves just his shevet when they do that. Number two is v'kavshu al tzorach kol Yisrael. When they conquered the areas of David Yeshua, it was for the all of Bnei Israel's benefit. Kodem chaluka, before they divide it up. Avot David lo kavash al tzorcho. David captures it for his own benefit. This is Rashi's view of what kibush yachid means, which is that kibush yachid is associated with two parameters here. The first of which is it's a difference between all of Israel doing it versus an individual doing it. Number two is it's for the benefit of all Israel versus the benefit of a yachid. And that's what distinguishes the conquest of David from the conquest of Yoshua. Then the Balei Tosafot, not Tosafot here, but on the Amud Aleph, Tosafot says this. It has to do with the requirement to conquer all of core Eretz Yisrael before you extend the borders of Eretz Yisrael to the greater Eretz Yisrael. And so the problem in the time of David is that the Yevusi are still in Yerushalayim. David has yet to conquer Ir David and Yerushalayim, and now he conquered the areas up in the northeast of Syria. And so the ability to append areas to Eretz Yisrael and have them have Kedushat Aretz is only the case when you've conquered the core areas of Eretz Yisrael first. But since there was a absence of that in the core Eretz Yisrael, I mean, there were still pockets of areas which were not conquered within Eretz Yisrael, then conquering in the northeast in Syria beyond the, call them the borders of Eretz Canaan, but within the borders of the greater Eretz Yisrael described in Breshit and in Devarim, there, that Kedusha can only be attained if the core Eretz Yisrael has full Kedusha, then you can extend it. David extends it before that happens. And because of that, it doesn't take on the status of Kedushat HaAretz. Those what in other places bring an alternate view of what Kibush Yachid is, the definition or the difference between Kibush Yachid and a Kibush that is Mekadesh is that you require Sanhedrin, Urim Vitumim, you require all the trappings that allow it to become a Milchama that is approved by the Sanhedrin and by a Kodesh Baruch Hu and by the Navi in order to gain the status of Kedusha, which wasn't necessarily the case when David went to conquer those areas up in Aram, and that's why it's deemed to be a Kibush Yachid. So those three different possibilities as to what the explanation of Kibush Yachid is, or what the deficit here is in creating a Kedusha to that area. Obviously the Istana believes that none of those are required, and therefore Kibush Yachid Shmei Kibush, meaning that whether you lack the Urim V'Tumim in the Sanhedrin, whether you lack Kol Yisrael, or whether all of Eretz Yisrael is yet to be conquered, none of those are ma'akev, your ability to mekadesh areas that are under the greater borders of Eretz Yisrael. And therefore it gains full status of Kedusha, and it has Kedushat Aretz, that area. And that's why you're chayav in Masrot and Shvi'it. Again, here it seems min ha-Torah, that you're chayav in those areas for mitzvot ha-tuliot Aretz. I wrote, Seli kaneis la-le-tara nichnas. Now, if you want to go in there, betara, you can. V'ha-amart, didn't you just say before Afratameh? Didn't you say that it has a status of chutz la-aretz in terms of Eretz Amim? If Eretz Amim, the land is Tameh, then why would you be Tahor if you entered into Syria? So when it says, v'shida teva u'migdal, if you enter into by a chest, bureau, or a tower of sorts, like armoire, you go in there in some sort of enclosure that takes you over there. Titania, we have a breita that we bumped into more recently in Nazir. Hanichnas le'eretz amim, b'shida teva u'migdal. Someone who goes into Eretz Amim in an enclosure. Rabbi mitamei. Rabbi says you're tamei because he believes oel zaruk lo shmei oel, that a moving oel is not considered to be an oel, therefore you're not afforded the protection of the enclosure that you're in, and you become tamei. Rabbi Yosef Rabbi Yehuda mitaher. And then Rabbi Yosef Rabbi Yehuda says it's fine, and you are protected, and you are tahor. Afilu Rabbi lo ka mitamei elo be'eretz amim. Rabbi himself only says this is a problem within Eretz Amim. The gazru al husha ve'al avira. Because over there, they were goes there both on the land itself to be tamei, as well as the airspace to be tamei. Aval Surya al gusha gazru. On the land, they were gozer, alavira lo gazru. On the airspace, they were not gozer. And therefore, you can enter the airspace without becoming tamei. There is a number of issues with the girsa here versus the girsa in Nazir as to what is the determinant of the tumah in the air? If you're in the air, why are you tameh? Are you tameh because gusha, because the ground is tameh, or are you tameh because the avir is tameh? The way that we're learning it here, the Girsa seems to indicate that the avir is the determining factor. If the avir is tameh, then you are tameh. The question might be, and this is the way that some of the Rishonim learn it in Nazir, is that the question of Gusha is a much more serious type of institution, that the Gush, the land itself, is Tameh, and therefore it would not only be Tameh, the land itself, but it have too much Ohel associated with it. Not only is the land itself Tameh, but also anything above the land is considered to be Tameh. On the other hand, if you say it's just Avira that's Tameh, that's a lighter form of Takana. And therefore, in that lighter form of takana, they didn't make it that you would be affected by the tumat ha'ohel. So Tosfot, in trying to address that, says that the question in Nazir is slightly different than the question that is over here. And that's what he says. V'hami ba'ilon b'Nazir. Wasn't this a question in Nazir, whether you are tamei in the airspace or not? So he says over there, Eretz ami mishum gusha gazru leo mishum avira gazru. Hachi perusho. Mishum gusha. Why was it Mishum Gusha Mishum Mahil Ala Gushu? It's because you make an oil over the ground. Vaso Chachamim Kamahil Ala Mate. And it's as if you have too much oil like over a mate. V'yecholi Kanesha Mishida Teva Migdal. And you can go in there in an enclosure. Oh, Dumala Viratzmo. Or maybe it's on the airspace itself. Alo Yuchali Kanesha Mishum Inyan. And you can't enter there no matter what. Even if you are enclosed, if you go into the airspace, you are Tameh. This is the way that Tosfot learns the Gemara in Nazir, that the difference between Gush and Avir is that Avir is much more Chamur. If you make the Avir Tameh, then the airspace itself makes you Tameh, and there's no protection from it. No Ohel will protect you from it, because the airspace itself is Tameh. On the other hand, if you think the Tumat derives from the ground, then it has the regular trappings of Tumat Ohel. If you have the regular trappings of Tumat Ohel, then an Ohel that's over will protect you from Tumat Ohel. If you're enclosed in something, you can enter an area that has Tumat Ohel, and it'll follow the regular rules of Tumat Ohel, and therefore you just have to determine whether you're in an Ohel or not, which is the machlok between Rabbi and Rabbi Yossi and Rabbi Yehuda, as to whether when you're moving in an object, whether that's considered to be an Ohel or not. Tosfot says it's two stages of questioning. The question Nazir addresses how you get Tumat Avir. The answer is that it's a separate takana. Then the Gemara, once it says that here, says, okay, if it's a separate takana, then we can divide between the two things, which is that in Eretz Amim you have both. Surya, you only have one. You have Tumat Gusha Aretz, but you don't have Tumat Avir in Surya. Had it all derived from Tumat Aretz or Gush, then it would make no difference whether you're in Surya or in Eretz Amim. So that's what Tosafot is suggesting, that it's a staged question. Question in Nazir is a much earlier question. Once you make that determination, then you come here and you have this possibility or this distinction between Gush and Avir. Does it ask then, what's the nafkamina? If already Avir is Tameh, then what does it matter that the Gush is not Metameh Bo'ohel? So the answer is that it could be if you bring dirt from Eretz Amim into Eretz Yisrael, or you have part of a bridge that goes from Eretz Yisrael into Chutz Laretz and then is Mahil on the Eretz Amim, whether it has a din of Tumah. So there are small nafkamina that you can come up with that would distinguish or make a difference whether the Tumat Oel derives from the Gush or derives from the Avir itself. The Rabbeinu Tam, on the other hand, takes a different approach, which is that, in the end, that the Takana of Tumat Avir basically says that the Gush is Mitameh Ba'ohel. And he says that the Mishnah and Olot that separates or segregates between these two issues was earlier on, before they were Mitakein, that the Avir is Mitameh. And therefore, the Mishnah and Olot that says you're only Mitameh Tumat Magan Masa with regards to the Gush of the land of Chutz La'aretz, that was an earlier takana. The later takana included avir, which made it that it's mitameh ba'ohel as well. So the Rabbeinu Tam conflates the issues and says the takana of avir changes the status of the gush, not that it's a separate takana versus the first view in Tosafot, which is that they are separate takanot, and that the avir is a separate takana from the gush itself. Again, this relates very much to the way that the girsa plays out in the Gemara in Nazir as to which is the cause of the more chamur result of Tumat Oel, whether it's the Gush or the Avir. The way that Tosfot concludes here is that the Tumat Avir derives from the Gezerah or Takana of the Avir, separate from the Gush, which means that the land itself does not create Tumat Oel, and that means that you don't even have to be in an enclosure. As long as you're not touching the ground, then you'd be fine, which means that if you're riding on an animal, or you're riding on a wagon, you'd also not have Tumah in Surya, because you're not touching the physical ground. It's a physical ground that creates Tumah and Suria, not the airspace. As long as you're separated somehow from the ground, that would be enough to make it that you are not Tameh. Rashi says this, the only way you become Tameh in terms of Gazrua Gusha is Maga Masav Velo Ohel. Only if you come into contact or you move it, but not with Ohel. And that means that if you went in there, you're riding on an animal, you could be any way that you're separated from the ground would be sufficient grounds to make you not Tameh. You don't literally need to go into there Bishida Teva Migdal, that's Lav Dafka. And by not touching the ground, you would not be Tameh. Someone who buys land in Syria is like buying in the best lots in Yerushalayim. The Mai Hilchata. What's Halacha? Marashesh Lamar. Shekotvim Alav Ono. Vafilu B'Shabbat. You can write the deed to the land, or you can write the contract to buy the land, even on Shabbat. Meaning that there is a dispensation to transact on Shabbat to gain land in Eretz Yisrael, Mishum Yishuv Eretz Yisrael, we'll see that in 1 second. The Shabbat Salkadatcha, how could you write on Shabbat? That's a Mlacha Doraita, even for a mitzvah of Yishuv Eretz Yisrael, it's not going to override a Din Doraita of doing Mlacha on Shabbat. Kedama Rava, as explained by Rava, Omer Lobeid Kochavim Boseh, Amir La'akum is dropped. You're allowed to ask a non-Jew to write the contract or sign the contract on your behalf. Hachanami Omer Lobeid Kochavim Boseh, so too over here. The same idea is true, which is that we allow you to do something to take possession of the land of Israel, as long as it's only a din derabonon. Even though it's an isur derabanan, and normally we would not waive it. Meaning that anything that you can't do on Shabbat, an Ovid Kilchavim cannot do for you on Shabbat, because that's what Amir Lakum is. Amir Lakum is you can't tell a goy to do what you can't do on Shabbat. So if you can't do something, it should be asur. How come it's permitted over here? Mishum Yishuv Eretz Yisrael goes to Rabbanan. The Rabbanan suspended their gzeira of Amir Lakum in the face of Yishuv Eretz Yisrael. So that's amazing. Again, this is what I described to you before. You could buy a nice apartment in Damascus, and that would be considered Yishuv Eretz Yisrael according to this. And what is Yishuv Eretz Yisrael? Rashi describes it here, very interesting the way Rashi describes it. The Garesh Ovdei Kochavim V'Liyashev Ba Yisrael. Rashi has two aspects to it. You would have thought Yishuv Eretz Yisrael is simply that a Jew settles in the land. Rashi has two sides of that, which is, not only is it the settling of the Jews in Eretz Yisrael, but it's the removal of the Ovdei Kochavim from Eretz Yisrael. In that, in this situation where he's purchasing it from an Ovid Kochavim, he accomplishes both. He removes the Ovid Kochavim and he settles it as a Jew. So this mitzvah of Shum Eretz Yishuv Eretz Yisrael, seemingly according to Rashi, only has application when you're purchasing it from a non-Jew, not when you're purchasing it from a Jew. Had you purchased it from a Jew, we wouldn't allow an Ovid Kochavim to come and do something like this, Mishum Eretz Yisrael. Because Yishuv Eretz Yisrael is not simply about you settling in the land, it's who you're displacing when you settle into the land. Yishuv Eretz Yisrael, according to Rashi, includes both of those aspects. You could have seen it, that simply Yishuv Eretz Yisrael is your living in the land, nothing to do with who you displace in living in the land. Rashi does not term it that way. The Rosh over here does narrow the scope of the heter to writing and documenting the Kinyan, meaning that the Kinyan was done before Shabbat and simply documentation. But most of the poskim see this as a blanket het there to complete the transaction. That means you could do the kinyan on Shabbat. Not only the kinyan on Shabbat, but you can write on Shabbat. So they'll reinforce the kinyan or evidence of the kinyan. You can do all of that on Shabbat if it brings you to the point where you can close on the deal and you can do Yishuv Eretz Yisrael. It's a very broad het there with regards to Yishuv Eretz Yisrael. That Amir Le'akum is suspended for any malacha that is involved in the acquisition of the property. Tosfot here discusses the extent of this heter over here, whether it's limited to Yishuv Eretz Yisrael or its application in other areas. As Tosfot points out, that the same issue comes up with regards to Milah. And with the Brit Milah, we also allow Amir La'akum in situations where it makes it possible to do the Brit Milah or to help out the baby in those situations. And so Tosfot again says the same qualifications as we have here, that it's not in issues d'oraita, it's only in issues d'rabanan, and then you can do Amir la'akum. But Tosfot then says maybe it's limited to these special types of mitzvot, like Brit Milah and Yishuv Eretz Yisrael, not all inclusive. If any time you're doing a mitzvah, automatically Amir la'akum becomes mutar, and that the suspension of this takana is uniquely associated with these very, call them important mitzvot of Yishuv Eretz Yisrael and Brit Milah, but it's not a broad heter to use a mila akum in the face of any mitzvah. And what is unique here is that we do have in other places something called shvut to shvut, which is when you have a double derabanan, but makom mitzvah, in many cases, we allow such a thing to take place. Over here, the unique aspect is that the amir la'akam is to do a malacha de'oraita. He's going to write. He's going to sign a contract. He's doing a malacha de'oraita for you. That is very unique to this aspect of Yishuv Eretz Yisrael, and may also not even be applicable by Brit Milah, which is that ability to use Amir Akum to deal with an issue d'oraita, that may be solely unique to Yishuv Eretz Yisrael, and not usable by the case of Brit Milah. So you'll actually have different types of heterim. You'll have Amir Akum, which is suspended for Yishuv Eretz Yisrael, even in Melachot d'oraita. You'll have Amir Akum, which is suspended for Brit Milah by Mitzvot d'Rabbanan, where it's a Shvut to Shvut. But in other cases of shvut to shvut, where it's a double derabanan, where usually we would suspend it by makom mitzvah, amir la'akum does not get suspended, and we see that in the Gemara and Rosh Hashanah with regards to shofar, that we don't allow you to violate a shvut to shvut to bring the shofar or to do amir la'akum, even though it's only an isur derabanan that is involved. We don't allow you to use amir la'akum to bring the shofar in order to blow the shofar on Rosh Hashanah. So you see here that the three different gradations, Yishuv Eretz Yisrael being at the highest of those gradations, then Brit Milah, and then Shar Mitzvot. Whereas the Tosfot read disagrees with Tosfot over here and says, Perush, Shvut HaNaseh Yedei Maaseh Yisrael, an Yisrud Rabbanan that involves action, an activity by a Jew, Kagon Hazah, sprinkling the Mei Tahara onto somebody on Shabbat, is an Yisrud Rabbanan, because it's Tikkun Gavra. Over there, ukuyotziba, things that are similar to it, hemidu hachamim divriyem b'makom karet. The chamim upheld their word even in the face of karet. Aval amir l'nachrish, ein sham ma'aseh al yedei Yisrael. On the other hand, amir l'akum, which is just speaking and not an action by Yisrael, el amira b'luchud lo hemidu divriyem b'makom mitzvah. They did not uphold their word in a makom mitzvah, and therefore the Ritos would read, sees this as being a broader heter with regards to Amir la'akum, involving mitzvot, because it's a violation of a din derabanan through Amira versus through Maaseh, therefore it can be suspended not only for Yishuv Eretz Yisrael, but can be suspended for other mitzvot like Milah, seemingly only mitzvot that involve a chiyuv karet, not just any old mitzvah. Alright, derabanan. Eved she'vi gito, v'katuv bo, atzmicha, v'nichsai kanuyin l'cha. Written in the get, now the word get here, as you can see, is used in its more broader sense, which means any type of contract, or here, more along the lines of a get, shichrur, which is a document of emancipation for the eved, which is similar to a get for an isha, which gives her her freedom to make choices then to whom to marry. So here, he brings for himself a get. In that document is written that he and all the possessions of his master are given over to the Eved. Now, the Braita says, Atzmo kana, he himself is kone, meaning that he wins his freedom. Nechasim lo kana. On the other hand, the possessions of his master he does not get. So, by the way, what happens if the wording is slightly different? Which is, Konechsai kanuim lecha. All of my possessions are given to you. The Adon, the master writes to an Eved, all of my possessions are given to you. Amongst his possessions are the Eved himself. I mean that he is one of the possessions of this individual. So when he does that, mahu, does it have the same din as what we said before? In the get shichur that's written before, there's a segregation between the eved and the possessions. And in doing so, we say basically the eved wins his freedom, but he doesn't get access to the other items. The other hand here, where they incorporate everything in one, which is that all my possessions belong to you, is there a different outcome? So Amar Abai, mitok shekana atzmo, kana nechasim. Samigo, since through that wording, he's going to acquire himself, he also therefore acquires all the possessions. And it's different than the previous Braita, which is now he can acquire himself plus all the possessions of his master because they're all incorporated in a single statement. Samalei Rova, Bishlamo atzmo liknei midi have a get isha. Of course, it makes sense that he acquires his own freedom because that's no different than a get of isha, bill of divorce. El nechasim lo liknei midi have a kiyum shtarot alma. But the nechasim he shouldn't get because of kiyum shtarot v'alma. Now this already brings you into understanding the case a little more, which is not simply that we have a document that is giving us information, but rather, as the braita we said before says, eved shehevi gito. This is a case where the Eved himself brought his document of emancipation, as well as technically the deed to all of his master's property. He's bringing it from outside of Eretz Yisrael. And what you see here is that he has to make the same declaration that a woman makes, which is, b'fanai nechtav, u'b'fanai nechtam. What the exact relationship between the get shichrur of an Eved and the get gerushin of the woman is, will come up in tomorrow's daf in the Mishnah. But Rashi over here claims that the same takana that was put in place for in the igun of a woman has application also by a get shichrur of an Eved, and that the saying of b'fanai nechtam has the same impact. Clearly here the issue of lishma is less relevant, but Edim Mitzuyim is a big deal, and here we want him to affirm the get. So what Rova says over here is that we bifurcate the din. As far as his freedom and this being a document of emancipation, we will say that b'fanai nechtam is sufficient grounds to free him. Just like a woman who brings a get and says b'fanai nechtam, she's also given her freedom to marry based on that is a bill of divorce. On the other hand, with regards to monetary matters, he wants to now take possession of all of his master's property. Over there, you're not dealing with where the institution of b'fanai nechtam is working, but you're dealing with a regular kiyum shtarot. You're dealing with the affirmation of a shtar in general. That does not have this dispensation. We saw that already. You require 3 edim or a beit din to come and affirm and give it a seal that it is such. And b'fanai nechtam is not sufficient grounds to make that affirmation in a regular contract. It works for a get isha. It works for get shichur, we're seeing now. But it doesn't work in a regular contract. So as far as his freedom, he gets that with b'fanai nechtam. On the other hand, as far as the possessions, he's not going to get that because that's part of the regular rubric of kiyum shtarot, and he has no way to affirm the shtar over here. He's a single individual bringing a shtar, that then he's saying, b'fanai nechtam, that's not sufficient grounds to make it a kiyum shtarot. Hadar amar Abaye. So then Abaye now changes his mind a little bit. Abaye changing his mind, he's not influenced by Rova. It's not that Rova changed his mind because he doesn't agree with Rova now. He just changes his mind about his position, which is Hadar amar Abaye. B'tolch shlo kana nechasim, lo kana atzmo. Abaye at first says, well, listen, if it works to get him his emancipation, then it works to get him the possessions as well. It's all under one contract that says, Kol, all my possessions belong to you. So then when he says, b'fanai nechtam, and we uphold the contract as far as his freedom, as a side effect, you're also upholding the contract with regards to the monetary matters, because they're not two separate issues. As opposed to the bright that we brought before, where you can bifurcate the din, because he's separated between the freedom of the slave and the possessions. You can say, we'll affirm the freedom, we're not going to affirm the possessions. When it's written as one, it says, all my possessions, then when you affirm it as far as his freedom, then automatically you're also affirming it as firm as the possessions. That was Abaye's original thought. Then Abaye now just says, no, you know what? That's not right. You're right in one sense, Rava, which is that it doesn't work for the possessions. But then Abaye says, if it doesn't work for the possessions, it doesn't work for the freedom as well. What Abaye sees is that the din has to be the same. You cannot bifurcate the din. And their argument really revolves around a concept called pagin and dibura. Are you able to bifurcate a person's testimony or a contract and say that a part of it is true and a part of it is not true? Abaye says no. So you have one of two outcomes. Either the whole contract is fine, or the whole contract is not fine. Those are the two positions we've seen in Abaye. Rava says, no, pagin and dibura. We split the contract. Bifurcate the din. With regards to freedom, emancipation, it's good. As far as possession of his property, of his adon, it is no good. And it's the equivalent case to what we brought in the Braitha before. Others still think that Abaye is influenced by Rava's statement, which is that there's no way that the nechasim can be transferred over here, are required over here, and therefore Abaye is forced to look at it the other way, based on his shita, that you can't separate between the issues, then if you can't take the nechasim, he can't take his freedom as well. I agree with you with regards to the possession of the property, because that is like affirming contracts in general, which doesn't work when you come and say, b'fanai nechtam, that doesn't work that way. Why is his emancipation any worse than a get isha where b'fanai nechtam works? El Amar Rava. Rava says, echad zeh. Doesn't matter how you phrase it. Whether you phrase it as him separate from the possessions or kol nechasai, atzmo kana, nechasim lo kana. He is koneh himself. He's not koneh the possessions. Basically, the din is bifurcated between these two issues. Amalei Rav Adar Bar Matna, the Rava. Kiman. Rava, who is your position like? this idea that you can split the din, even though it's written in a single contract, and it's the wording that's used there is the same wording that grants him his emancipation as it grants him the possession of his Adon's possessions. He says, Rabbi Shimon, damar pagin and dibura. It's like the Tana Rabbi Shimon who says that when a person comes to make testimony in court, we can bifurcate his statement. So for an instance, in a case where he says, I and so-and-so did something, and that something is illegal or an avera, then what we say is, in adam asim etzmo rasha, we don't believe him with regards to himself, but we do believe his testimony with regards to the other individual. That's called pagina dibura. We're able to bifurcate what he says and say that even though he made a single statement, we'll believe him with regards to the other party. We're not going to believe him with regards to himself. Person who writes all of his possessions to his slave, yatsa ben chorin, he goes free. Shier karka kosho lo yatsa ben chorin. If in the contract he leaves out any of his possessions, then he doesn't go free. Because our assumption based on the Tanakam is that when he leaves something out, and that's what Rashi writes over here, it's karka lav dafka. It doesn't have to be land that he leaves out. If he leaves anything out, we can no longer assume that when he put everything in, he says all my possessions, he literally means everything, including the Eved. Because as soon as he starts to leave something out, we can say, just like he left that out, he meant to leave the Eved out as well, or he meant to leave the Eved. If you just make a general statement that everything, then the Eved is included in everything. If you leave out anything from the contract, then we start to suspect that maybe he didn't mean everything. And everything is almost everything, but not everything. Rabbi Shimon disagrees and says, Omer, l'olam hu ben chorim, so Rabbi Shimon changes very slightly the nuance of the language, but makes a big difference. Rabbi Shimon says, if you specify or delineate what you're leaving out, the Eved still goes free. On the other hand, if you leave out a percentage of the estate, or some amount of the estate without clarifying what it is, then you have to worry about the Eved. Because the Eved is one of the possessions, and if you say I leave out 1/10,000th of it, then we don't know which 1/10,000th you left out. If you left out the 1/10,000th with the Eved, then the Eved doesn't go free, because the only way for an Eved to go free is to completely free. It can't be partially free. And so therefore, Rabbi Shimon says, that is Ma'akev. On the other hand, if you specify what you leave out, then the Eved is not included in that specification. And that's what Rashi says, Lolam Buen Chorim, Demai the Gully Gully, Demai the Lo Gully Lo Gully. Rabbi Shimon says that we look at what you said, and whatever you made clear is clear, and what you didn't make clear is not clear. So, over there, in the case where you leave out a specific item from the contract, then the Eved goes free. You specified whatever it was you wanted to leave out. It didn't include the Eved. Why were you going to suspect that you left the Eved out? Whatever you wrote is what you wrote. So you said everything, except this. Well, except this means exactly that, except this. Whereas, according to the Tanakhama, when you say except this, we start to suspect that you didn't really mean everything. And then we start to say, wait, is everything really everything? Because you've now said everything but. Everything but means that you're not giving everything. And that's what the Tanakhama's suspicion is. Rabbi Shimon says, no, if you specify, then you've delineated exactly what is everything and what is not everything. On the other hand, if you use a generic language or an ambiguous language that says that I'm giving away everything except 1/10,000, then you have the problem that the Tanakhama has, which is now we don't know. It's not identifiable what you left out. And there we have to suspect that it also includes the Eved. And that's what Rashi says over here. Mi dekama Rabbi Shimon, de olam hu ben chorin, that he's always a free person. Ashminan, lo shna hecha dekana shar nechasim imo. It doesn't matter whether the other possessions go or not go. Meaning that Rabbi Shimon's okay to leave out some possessions and let the Eved go free. And it makes no difference where the other possessions are not included. So that's the way Rashi sees the proof here to the fact that Rava is holding like Rabbi Shimon. Again, we're going to continue tomorrow with this sugya, and then we'll discuss that Tosafot has a slightly different view of why Rabbi Shimon is supportive of Rava's position. But the basic idea of Rava is we're able to bifurcate the din, give emancipation to the Eved, even though he doesn't get possession of the items, unlike Abaye, who sees it as being a single rule. It's either is or isn't. So either he gets freed and he gets all the possessions, or he gets neither. In the end, Abaye changed his mind and says he gets neither. But Rova, in both instances, says it's a bifurcation of the din, and therefore he gets his own freedom, but he does not get the possessions. And as Rabada Ramatna says to Rova, who are you holding like Rabbi Shimon of Pagina and Dibura? And then, again, that will bring us down a new path of understanding this Pagin and Dibura and how it relates to Rava's position. Again, we started the sugya now. We'll continue with it tomorrow. Stopping here, three lines down on the top of Tet Amud Aleph.